Well, hello, Gallatin Valley and the world. You are listening to 95.9 FM KGVM Bozeman Community Radio. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. As always, we're going to open the show with an episode of Desert Oracle Radio, and I want you to stay tuned in the second half because we're going to be talking about some local wildlife and some events and spirits. So we're going to open the show today with the latest episode of Desert Oracle Radio. And this one was produced by Ken Lane on October 6th, 2023, so just last Friday. And it's titled
Horrors of the Night.
Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, which means it's night in America here in the season of autumn. A black cat appeared here at the haunted temple of Santa Minerva, a suspiciously bold and friendly cat, likely harboring an old deity. The owls have been swooping low and hooting long into the night. The fireplace is back in use after another long summer. A summer that felt as if it had returned. These last few days, a common occurrence in October, like in the old William Wilfred Campbell verses, you might remember. Along the line of smoky hills, the crimson forest stands. And all the day the blue jay calls throughout the autumn lands. Now by the brook the maple leans with all his glory spread. And all the sumacs on the hills have turned their green to red. Now by great marshes wrapped in mist or past some river's mouth. Throughout the long, still autumn day, wild birds are flying south. This is the time for a certain kind of story, a type of tale we often tell on this radio program. But during these weeks of October, I will tell you a few more and I'll worry even less about where they take place. For they all take place in a season of growing darkness. Tonight I want to tell you a ghost story. Without making any claims regarding what a ghost is, because I don't claim to know. But we know some broader meanings of the word ghost from the old High German word Geist, which shares the Proto-Indo-European root and can mean the spirit of the time, as in the German Zeitgeist, or Time Ghost. And it can be a noisy supernatural entity, as in Poltergeist. Geist relates to a kind of religious agitation and/or being frightened. Both the German and English words can refer to spirits of the haunted, of the holy, and of the alcoholic varieties, as well as the spirit of mind and mass consciousness. I suppose all of these meanings play a role in this story, not least the Zeitgeist. Because this story takes place in the golden city of Prague in the days after the Velvet Revolution, when thousands of Westerners, Americans mostly, suddenly appeared in this medieval city where alchemists and magicians and other misfits and artists had been welcomed by Rudolf II. In the 16th century. The place where Jewish mystics created Golem the Avenger. And where the weirdest and most underground elements of mid-20th century culture took root before the Soviets crushed the Prague Spring in August of 1968. But the ghost in this story very much fits the Czech word strašidlo, a supernatural spirit. It paid a spectral visit to the four of us. Four young Americans on a cold winter's night on the edge of Prague. The street name will give you a sense of what this part of town was like in that freezing gray winter time in the new year of 1993. Elektrárenská, meaning power plant. You reach this ground floor apartment by walking about a mile alongside various industrial facilities and an electric bus storage yard, and generally no other visible humans. Other than inside the building itself, where there was a simple working man's pub, where most of the clientele wore the blue coverall uniform of the power plant and the cigarette smoke obscured anything not directly in front of you. Like the barman who was always growling and grumbling because I'd bring in this enormous hollow log beer pitcher to get filled up for a pocket full of coins. The pitcher, it turned out, was some sort of novelty hollow log pitcher not meant for real or regular use. So it leaked terribly, and it had no lid, meaning every trip to the apartment lobby pub meant a trail of beer on the way back. It wasn't really my apartment. I was subletting it from my dear friend Matt Welch, as he had taken over the newspaper bureau that I'd established in Bratislava on the ground floor of Slovakia's Pravda building, and I'd come back to Prague. The country had split apart, old Czechoslovakia, I mean. And after what they called the Velvet Divorce was complete with a whimper instead of a war, I'd handed my Bratislava office keys to Welch, one of the English language newspaper in Prague's founders and editors. And he'd given me the keys to his grimy, gloomy little flat in Prague 10, which was 6 kilometers and a very long bus ride and a world away from the people and the action and the coal-smoking medieval streets and the all-night life I loved in that town. Anyway, that's why I include myself in those 4 young Americans. Because 1993 was 3 decades ago, at which time I was significantly younger. So I had gone to sleep after midnight on a trifold mattress pad on the floor of this little apartment in a foreign land. But my eyes opened to a situation I immediately recognized from childhood and occasional instances since. I was awake, my mind alert, but I could not move. Next to me, only inches away from my eyes, was a long wooden wardrobe of mid-century Middle Europe style, 3 doors of shiny wood veneer, musty old bedding and linens inside. The center door of the wardrobe, the one closest to me, was moving. It was opening very slowly towards me. And then with its lower corner nearly touching my forehead, it would close back again. Just as slowly. And then this maddening routine would repeat. I tried and failed to go back to sleep. From the other side of the bedroom, I heard light breathing and the occasional snore from the people sharing the real bed. Visitors, a newly married young couple, my friends Brett and Linda. If they were fine, then I must be experiencing the sleep paralysis. The definition used in the scientific papers to dismiss whatever happens to people and such frozen moments of terror. If only I could get back to sleep. How long had it been? Well, this is when a new wrinkle became apparent, what you might call a wrinkle in time. I realized my wristwatch was in my line of sight. On my left wrist, uselessly petrified like the rest of me, but the watch was ticking and I could see it, and the second hand was making its way around the dial at what seemed like its normal pace. And so I spent the next 15 minutes or so watching the hands of my watch as regular time progressed from about 3:30 a.m. when I first noticed I could make out the time, till 3:45. That's when, in the northeast corner of the room at the foot of my makeshift bed, I now saw the 3 men standing, facing me. Their coats were long and black, like World War II trench coats. Their hats, though, were of narrow brim, mundane, the hats of bureaucrats, maybe in the late 50s, early 1960s. But all of this was dark, of minimal detail, and maximum dread. And still, I could not move. The air was stale and dry. The wardrobe door continued its slow movement, and I could not make a sound. Behind me, through the double glass window, looking out on a frozen little closed courtyard where people hung their wet laundry to freeze, brilliant white lights were erratically flashing. I could now see their reflection on the shiny veneer of the cabinet doors and see the dark trio of figures at the foot of my bedding. Those figures were looking at me, though I could not see their faces. And with that, the bedroom light switched on, and I heard a gasp, and then another, a gasp from my guests, my friends, and then the confused, quiet voice of Linda, I think. Is something happening? The spell, or whatever you want to call it, was broken. The enchantment had come to an end. I found I could move again, and I sat right up. Nobody ever got back to sleep that night, as you might imagine. But no sooner had the three of us begun whispering about whatever had occurred, there was a knock on the bedroom door, and the third guest, who we'll call Kate, and who had been sleeping in my usual bed in the flat's main room, the combination living room kitchenette, had just woken from a terrible nightmare. The kind you can't remember at all, but it leaves you weeping and shaken. Somebody put a kettle on the burner, and we all had cups of tea and smoked cigarettes, because we all smoked back then. And so the four of us sat on the floor in a magic circle and sipped our tea and talked about what had occurred. For Brett and Linda, the young couple sharing that bedroom with me, voices had come up from beneath their bed, it seemed, and sounded distinctly Japanese. Then came the lights pulsing through the double window from the empty little courtyard with its frozen mud and clotheslines and one miserly tree stripped of leaves. My third guest, who woke up crying and distraught without knowing why, was relieved to hear the rest of us whispering in the next room. That's when she knocked. I did not love the apartment because it was too far away from everything and cloaked in the dust of bachelor living and overall a hostile environment, especially in that pub. Even if it was all my fault for bringing that terrible Yule log decoration in there week after week. But I'd had no supernatural problems there before, although I had been warned. The narrow bed was in the living room kitchenette because the usual occupant, my friend and comrade who had traded keys with me, refused to sleep in the real bedroom when he lived there alone, because he did not like the vibe. when his guitar was left alone in that bedroom, for example, it would sometimes begin to play as if someone was strumming the open strings. Thinking about this strange night and that long ago winter time, I am reminded that the weird phenomena some of us call high strangeness can create a variety of experiences. Even within the same group of people in the same place at the same time. Like with the famous poltergeist hauntings involving adolescents, the wild hormones and emotions of a child becoming psychically mature and physically mature, combined to generate or attract all manner of restless spirits and random horrors to an entire household. Adults at odds with one another, especially when those adults have a close relationship, can also produce the poltergeist effect. In April of 1909, Sigmund Freud and Carl Gustav Jung tried to come to terms with their competing theories, an ultimate vision of psychological reality. As their conversation became more heated, the bookcases and walls of Freud's home produced dramatic crashes and bangs. Carl Gustav Jung later described it this way. It interested me to hear Freud's views on precognition and parapsychology in general. When I visited him in Vienna in 1909, I asked him what he thought of these matters. Because of his materialistic prejudice, he rejected this entire complex of questions as nonsensical. While Freud was going on in this way, I had a curious sensation. It was as if my diaphragm were made of iron and was becoming red hot, a glowing vault. And at that moment, there was such a loud report in the bookcase, which stood right next to us, that we both started up in alarm, fearing the thing was going to topple over on us. I said to Freud, "Now there is an example of a so-called catalytic exteriorization phenomenon." "Oh, come on," he exclaimed. "That is sheer nonsense." "It is not," I replied. "You are mistaken, Herr Professor." And to prove my point, I now predict that there will be another loud report. Sure enough, no sooner had I said the words than the same detonation went off in the bookcase. To this day, I do not know what gave me this certainty. Now, Freud would later write to Jung that while the poltergeist activity, quote, made a powerful impression on me, end quote, he had since determined that the creaking and slamming was mundane, simply the sounds of old furniture in an old house, and only by chance did the cabinet produce such dramatic banging right when the tension between the men was at its height. That meaningful coincidence, of course, exactly illustrated Jung's point. But Freud would not and could not go there. Jung had already chosen the path of the mystic, of the world mystical. Freud, already so vexed that he'd begun fainting in Jung's company, doubled down on sexual frustration as a source of all that occurs within the psyche. Their competing ideas and theories, sexual dissatisfaction on the Freudian side versus the now well-known Jungian concepts of introverts and extroverts, the anima and the animus, ancient archetypes, and the collective unconscious, were both radical views at the time, but it is Freud's view, which has gone out of style, while 21st century culture has widely adopted the views of Jung. The profession they founded, psychotherapy, has since grown into the $500 billion global mental health market, one of the leading growth industries in the world, with an 8% annual growth projected well into the next decade, which is 10 times the global population growth during that same time period. Go figure. Had I been taught more of the folklore and the customs of my various ancestors, I would have already known in 1993 how a person or groups of people often become the conduit for strange energies. And I would have known that those in proximity to one perceiving an event can often tune in to the same vision, sometimes by simply touching the one who perceives it. Here's a wonderful example from the classic study by Evans Wentz, The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, published in 1911, the same year Jung published his Symbols of Transformation, which would make his split with Freud permanent. From the Evans Wentz text, Conferring Vision of a Phantom Funeral. There used to be an old man at Newchurch named David Davis, who lived about 17 and 80 to 18 and 40, who was noted for seeing phantom funerals. One appeared to him once when he was with a friend. "Do you see it? Do you see it?" the old man excitedly asked. "No," said his friend. Then the old man placed his foot on his friend's foot and said, "Do you see it now?" And the friend replied that he did. From Amboy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver, and I am your host, Ken Lane. Join us again next week for more spooky stories as we head towards Halloween. And I will be wrapping up this haunted month of October with two live events. First, a radio show recorded for broadcast at Hucumba Hot Springs, that's an hour east of San Diego. And the show will take place within the enormously charged old ruins of the Hucumba Hot Springs bathhouse. Go to Hucumba.com, that's with a J, and click Happenings, Friday night, October 20. Aim to get there by dark, because it's a long, twisty road, and it always takes longer than you remember. There's some confusion about showtime, but it's going to be at 8 p.m. and you should be there by 7 p.m. Does that make sense? And then on Sunday, October 29th, Campfire Stories at the Tiny Pony in Yucca Valley in the high desert. Good night from the voice of the desert.
We are back, and you're continuing to listen to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, and we should be around the bottom of the hour by now. And this is KGVM 95.9 FM and streaming on KGVM.org. And I'm Roxana, and we're continuing on. We are in the pre-holiday season for Halloween. Yay, Halloween! I love it. And have you ever, you noticed that there's a bunch of cobwebs all over the place as decorations? And in my house, it's not decorations. There's actually cobwebs. So that got me wondering about what is it that's making those cobwebs. I'm going to read you a little passage from Nature, A Day at a Time, and that is by Kathy Katz. And she says, cobwebs are made by tangled web spiders. Their haphazard appearance is deceiving. They are effectively designed to protect the weaver as well as capture food. The spider throws sticky globs of silk to capture prey with a toss equal to any major league pitcher. When abandoned, the cobweb's tangle of threads and gobs picks up dust particles, usually in abundance in cellars and dark, unused places where they're typically found. Those unused, messy corner webs serve as a handy purpose in emergencies. The silk can be put on wounds to stop bleeding. Pharmaceutical researchers at the University of Wyoming have found that spider silk can be used on cuts. The silk effectively resists bacteria and viruses. Some hospitals now use spider silk externally as well as inside the body to store drugs that need to be released slowly. And then there's a quote at the bottom from Robert Burton in Nature's Nightlife. He says, before hygiene and cleanliness had such an important place in the home, cobwebs were valued as an instant dressing for minor cuts. They are quite clean when fresh. Well, if you've been listening to the news this week, you've probably heard the stories about grizzlies, both in the greater Yellowstone area and up in Canada. I've been reading a book by Doug Peacock called Grizzly Years. It is a fascinating book if you ever get a chance to read it. If you haven't yet, I highly recommend it. Doug has written so many books, quite a few of them on grizzlies. He's considered one of the area's experts, and he earns that name, in my opinion. So, anyway, I'm going to read you a little bit, and here's my disclaimer. I am not reading the following passage as a matter of instruction, or, you know, I'm not telling anybody, yeah, go out there and find a grizzly and watch it. No, 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 no. I'm only reading this to share some information that I came across that I found really interesting about grizzly bears and their behavior. This is in the chapter titled The Lookout in Doug Peacock's book, Grizzly Years. The only species of animal that tries to get by in the wilderness without interspecific tact or communication is the human critter. All other animals take stock of what others do and make adjustments in their lives for the behavior and presence of the rest of the animal kingdom. Bears have a body language in which the mere style of gait communicates mood, aggressiveness, and even changes in season. A young brown bear or on a salmon stream can tell at a glance if he should flee the big boar who is still 150 yards away. Elk know when grizzlies are predatory and when they can stand 50 feet away watching as a bear walks through the middle of their herd to the next berry patch. Grizzlies communicate with their size, posture, mouths, ears, and eyes. A grizzly standing on its rear feet, swinging its head, is only trying to see and smell better. Bears whoosh when alarmed, but are no threat to humans. A bear who woofs, but does not run away, is. If the grizzly opens and closes its jaw and slobbers, it's time to leave. A grizzly with its head lowered near or across a forepaw and looking off to the side is indicating a willingness to move on peacefully if you do. If the bear's head is turned off to the side, you can still get out without being chewed. Once the head is lowered straight on and the ears are flat back, you're probably going to get charged. If the eyes fix at the last moment and turn cold, you're in a world of beep. The icy stare is caused by the eyelids retracting to the corner of the eyes, revealing the yellow sclera. It happens only at the last second and is the final signal you'll see before flying fur. I hope you were able to get out to Raptor Fest this weekend. I have a little more from Steve Hoffman today, and he's going to be talking about falcons.
The little Darrow white-tailed wings on the Merlin. All Merlins have that. Females and juveniles are brown on the back, and the male is gray on the back. There's the male. Now, there's three different subspecies of Merlins that you can see in Bozeman. But the one that breeds here in town is called the Prairie Merlin. And the Prairie Merlin looks like this bird here. The male looks real. Look how white the head is. Mm-hmm. The Prairie Merlin is the lightest color. And the Black Merlin is the darkest on the Pacific coast. And then the Taiga Merlin is in between. So if you see a really super dark Merlin, that's probably came from the Pacific coast. You see a super light Merlin, that's probably the one we have here locally. And they also come through here from the prairies to winter farther south. And they're a cute little falcon. And I named my tour company after the Merlin. And we named our son after the Merlin. So you think I'm hung up on Merlins? female Prairie Merlin here is also really light colored, but brownish instead of gray. But that is definitely a Prairie Merlin right there. And the Prairie Merlin is the largest of the three Merlin subspecies. They're chunkier than the other Merlins. They're not nearly as large as the Peregrine or Prairie, though. But they all have that falcon shape and that falcon behavior. They flap their wings a lot more than the other raptors, and they fly faster. I mean, when you're up on the bridges, you can blink and miss a Merlin that flies so fast through there. They feel like they're going, it looks like they're going 100 miles an hour fast. They're in a hurry. So the black axillaries, the black armpits, black going out, very light head with a little tiny thin malar stripe and sandy brown back. The armpits are a dead giveaway if you're in good light. And the back is not nearly as dark as a peregrine. Peregrine's like slaty gray, almost black, whereas the prairie is really more tan, sandy brown. The white upper chest, but underneath the wings and the lower breast and belly, heavily barred. So underneath the wings, it generally looks dark, much darker than a prairie falcon. But this contrast is what you really want to look for to tell the two apart. If you can get light on that, if you can see the back color and it's a dark gray, that's a peregrine every time. And Caleb was an observer back in 2012, 2013, and he took this picture up in the bridges. And that bird was going for the out decoy. He was stooping in on the out decoy, and Caitlin just happened to snap the picture at the perfect time. This almost looks like it's got a little reddish in it, doesn't it? Might just be the sun going down, I don't know. And juvenile peregrines are heavily streaked, breast and belly, but they may have a little white area here in the chest, but it may not be completely dark everywhere. And brownish back, but very dark brown. So peregrine versus prairie. Much different head color. In the bridgers, we've seen one in 31 years. 32 years, yeah. But we keep hoping. They're an Arctic bird that rarely comes down this far south in the winter. But it's possible. And they don't have much of a facial pattern at all, and then they're heavily streaked. And they are a big, big falcon. They're Arctic all the way. And look how beautiful their light mark is.
There was one here last winter, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was.
Yeah, because we had a picture of that.
Yeah, there's actually one that seems to be hanging around White Sulphur Springs every winter.
A falcon?
Yeah, so we need to all do a trip to the, you know, late December, early January. We're done Christmas. Let's go to White Sulphur Springs and look for turf falcons. Wouldn't that be fun? Is that a picture or what? I just love that shot. That was Rob Palm.
Well, this week we're going to continue with some recordings from that ghost tour that I did a couple weeks ago. And this one will include stops at the Masonic Lodge number 18 and the Rialto Theater Alley and the Emerson School.
This is Masonic Lodge 18, later on was built in 1950 here. We assume that this place was in somebody's house for a brief time. So, not too sure about that as well, because during the rift, they had to have at least rifted to somebody's house briefly. Because there's no records of where it was located until the 1950s. And we might want to be my friend over here. Inside, but before it was a Masonic Lodge, it was several different businesses throughout the years and also apartments. And the ghost stories behind this place is it did attract the well-known author that wrote Haunted Montana, Karen Stevens, and more Haunted Montana and several other books. She did an investigation here, as well as I also helped with ghost tours here as well. Before she did a talk, she was doing an investigation here, and she saw an elevator, a long broken elevator, open by itself, and watched a blue light open up, like come out. Anyways, when we did an investigation here, and helped with tours, that they were telling us a story about when they had one of the youth groups in here. And they were getting ready to go and sleep in the other room and have a sleepover. Well, they were doing a meeting in one of the rooms that had a balcony. And they watched a white spirit, jump from the balcony and run out. Well, apparently all the kids still had to sleep in that building. And it did not get any better from there. They went into the other room, and there is a flag that is bolted to the ground, like the base is. Well, they were getting ready to go to sleep, and they had the flag fall over. Like, came out. It would have had to come out of its pedestal and fall over. It's a lot of energy to do that. Anyways, they also have a room in there that has never been opened. There's, like, no door. The door has never been opened. And I told them that they should never open this room. Don't know if they ever did. I'm hoping they didn't, because they see a man lurking that hallway that is not very nice. And they have named him Charlie. And I'm assuming that is his room. So, I've also heard music being played. They've also seen a maid in the kitchens. I guess there is kitchens up there, as you can tell. VIP dinner. And then also just a bunch of other sounds, also like little kids and whatnot as well. This is my pride and joy. Rialto Theater was built in 1907 as of a post office / general store. Later on, it came to be a theater. And it was also used for the National Guard for drill purposes. The famous opera singer Pablo Elvira also sang in here, and a bunch of other people as well that were, the only one I know about is Pablo. But anyways, it had a really hard time keeping ownership, so it definitely changed ownership throughout the years. And then back in 2014, we were able to do an investigation here. This was way before it looked like this. All it had was a sign was, like, about donating. They were a nonprofit, and they were trying to get this building to go afloat. Anyways, when we went through the EVP sessions during that time, we ended up finding a voice saying, Pablo, Pablo, Pablo. Well, a week later, one of my members and I were walking across the street, and we saw a star back over by the Ellen, which said Pablo Elvira. So if you guys go back over there, you'll see Pablo Elvira's star over there. Well, he was a very popular opera singer here, especially in Bozeman, and just personality, I can tell you that. I've had several people on this tour that knew him personally, and his son's still alive, and yeah, it's just pretty spooky. Well, in 2018, when they first opened this Rialto Theater, we literally came in like the month after they opened, and they were telling us, did you know that they've had people the first week that they opened asking if this place is haunted? Well, they go, well, we're going to see because Bozeman Paranormal is coming. And they've also caught evidence in the past. And they caught, apparently this lady that was approaching them said, you know, why? Because I watched my chair move on its own. And I was like, that's kind of weird. They've also seen shadow figures in here, especially when there used to be a basement. There's now just a crawl space. But, and they've also, one of my members has heard his name being called. They've seen a teenage boy upstairs. They've also, when we did an investigation here and I brought my friend Kathleen Johns, her husband used to play music with Pablo. So, and she's one of my psychic friends that comes out to investigate every now and again. Well, anyways, she was going to invite him to come out. Well, a funny story was that night, I didn't even mention Pablo until like that day, and because he was just going to come out and visit. And he goes, you're joking me, right? Because my husband used to play music with him, and he now doesn't feel very good, and he was going to come. Well, after the investigation was over, her husband was totally fine. So it's just kind of how the universe works, that people don't want people to meet each other. Well, when we were in there, we decided to play Pablo Elvira's music. And I started to feel like somebody touched my hair, and somebody touched her thigh, and my tech manager at the time, which you guys will know, Tim, was standing on the stage and felt a warm embrace go up to him. And he's never felt that before, and he normally doesn't have experiences. So, anyways, this is a chance for you guys to investigate. I know he gets a little freaked out by my ghost box, but this is a good spot for ghost box, so, because it's just so quiet. Look, it stopped completely. His thing is stopped. Yeah, that's weird. That is so weird.
Oh, it's not even green.
It pointed there, but I asked where it was, and it said it was over there.
Can you say hello? None of the spirits here are scary. I don't want to know what that spirit just told me. Can you tell us the... Oh, that was a very singy song. Can you tell us? Hello?
Hi.
Pablo.
I heard Pablo.
Yeah.
Are there more than one of them?
Pablo, can you tell? Sir, would you like to sing us a song? That's the same man's voice.
Sounded like Pablo.
Mm-hmm. Are you actually glad that I got these people out here to visit you?
I'm actually playing one of the songs right now. So this right here is Pablo.
Here's your music.
He's actually a really good singer. I never knew who he was until I started the tour with Elise. Pablo's right there singing.
He said hi. He was like, no. The only time I never hear from him is when they have parties in here. I think he'd rather be at the party than.
Oh, or maybe.
Yeah.
Either he doesn't like it or he really likes it.
Yeah, that's my thought. He also loves
that's Pablo.
So we notice that. He's a very happy spirit in here. This is his happy place. Yeah, and there's a woman.
There's two.
Yeah. Can you tell us your name?
He said no.
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 He also doesn't know I'm here.
Hi.
I know, there's lots of ladies here, I know.
Oh, yes. Do you like the rain?
Yes. And it sounded like someone said, yeah, in this here. Hello.
Hello. I keep saying hello.
It's the 21st.
Huh?
It's the
22nd. That was really weird.
It sounded like someone was like, oh.
Huh.
Oh.
Break away.
Maybe someone
else can break away. Oh, it's just Pablo. That's the same voice over and over and over again. It's creepy sometimes, but.
Yeah. Are you trying to I'm trying to find words.
Not me. That woman was like, not me. Clearly.
The lady's like, I'm not trying to speak to you.
Can you tell these people good night?
Never again.
Good night.
Good night.
That was so clear. That was so clear. I never had that so clear before. Oops, it's the sign that it wants to read you. The thing, it's because it's wet. The Emerson building was the original elementary school that was built in 1918. And a group of artists came together to keep this building afloat because they wanted to tear this building down. The reportings of ghost stories here are of full body apparitions, also sounds of voices, footsteps, bangs, and also they would see a woman in white in here. And it's so funny because I had somebody attend my tours that said that they attended this elementary school and that there was an art teacher or some kind of teacher in here that wasn't very nice. And sometimes when we're in here, I refer her to Rose. But I can't remember what name he gave me for the teacher name. But we always just call her Rose. She seems to like that. Well, she wasn't very nice. And she doesn't like us at all. Like anytime I'm ever here, there she's like, I don't want you here. Well, anyways, they've also seen shadow figures and hearing children running up and down the halls.
And there's an event coming up Saturday, October 14th. I really want to make sure you know about. It's from 9 to 11 in the morning, and it's at Tin Works Art, 719 North Ida Avenue, Bozeman. And it's going to be a solar eclipse performance by Suzanne Kite. I'm going to read you the text of the event. This performance by Tin Works artist Suzanne Kite is designed to coincide with the partial solar eclipse taking place on the morning of October 14th. Kite will perform a graphic score rooted in Lakota geometry and star knowledge, aligning her piece with the celestial events of the day. Participants will be provided with eclipse viewing glasses, or they can bring their own viewing device. This event will take place outside in the field of Tin Works campus at the corner of Cottonwood and Ida, across from Tree Line Coffee. Coffee and pastries will be served. My thanks to Steve Hoffman and Kathy Katz and Doug Peacock for the information that they shared, either by my reading their material or from their voice this time. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I want you to remember, you can call or text me and leave me a message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. So that's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. Norman Greenbaum is taking us out with Spirit in the Sky. Did you see this coming?